From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Suzette Grulot joins me from Italy today. Leaders in Brazil are trying to defuse protests sweeping its largest cities, and we'll talk about the implications of the newly elected moderate president for the future of a nuclear Iran.
Voters in Iran seem to have kind of overwhelmingly rejected the recent ultra-conservative regime.
And later, a conversation with University of California at Berkeley historian Daniel Sargent. He calls U.S. foreign policy immediately after the Cold War uninspiring.
Obama, I would argue, has retreated considerably from that ideological approach to the world towards a more balanced, realistic, or Kissingerian approach.
Why the 1970s were a pivotal decade on the global stage. After these news headlines from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. Well, Suzette, thank you for joining us from Italy. We're happy to have you on the program.
I'm happy to be here, my last leg of the international trip.
Well, we'll be thrilled to have you back in the studio next week. But for right now, you know, this seems to be a summer of protests here. We saw protests, or you literally saw protests in Turkey. We've got protests going on right now in the United Kingdom. And, of course, in Brazil, we're seeing thousands in the streets in major cities across Brazil really protesting the economic conditions as they're preparing for the World Cup next year and, of course, the Olympics in a couple of years. This seems to be somewhat of a surprise, given that Brazil was an economic success story here for the last decade or so. Leading the BRIC countries in GDP and really doing quite well. What's changed? What's going on here with these Brazilian protests?
Well, it has been interesting to watch Brazil develop in this way. The protests actually began over higher bus fares. Bus fares were being increased, and so this led to an outcry that, of course, like in Turkey, kind of expanded to consume all kinds of other issues, with protesters in the streets now concerned about everything from corruption to public spending on the World Cup and on the Olympics to really a desire for more public services. They pay extremely high tax rates in Brazil, and yet the citizenry, you know, was crying out for better schools and better access to health care. So this rising middle class that they have in Brazil has really led to increased expectations and increased participation in the streets. And the president's response there has been quite different than what we saw in Turkey, which has been particularly interesting to watch, as she has more or less embraced the protesters and has said that they are a sign of a strong civil society and a vibrant democracy. So we'll see, you know, how it happens there. But definitely interesting to watch in advance of, you know, the world watching what's going on in Brazil.
Well, and that's got to be very difficult for a number of people, right, as they're spending all this money on the new stadiums and all the infrastructural programs that they are now having to pay for, at the same time having issues with the educational services, as you mentioned. Well, the other big story, of course, of the week are the elections in Iran. Everyone watched with anticipation to see if we were going to have a repeat of 2009, where there were protests there. And somewhat of a surprising result with Hassan Rouhani becoming the new president, or he'll take office in August. People did seem to be very surprised by this. Were you surprised? Did you think this was an unusual outcome? And really, is this going to change much in terms of Iranian-U.S. relations moving forward?
Yeah, I think a lot of us were surprised. I mean, particularly because there were six candidates. I think many of us thought that there might not be a winner the first time around, that there might be a runoff. But as you mentioned, President-elect Rouhani won with 50.7% of the vote, and seems to be, you know, is the only kind of moderate voice in the pack. So voters in Iran seem to have kind of overwhelmingly rejected the recent ultra-conservative regime in Iran. You know, of course, how much is going to change is really to be determined. You know, the supreme leader in Iran certainly is the ultimate power holder. And so the relationship that emerges between these two and how that will have an impact on, let's say, the nuclear situation is really something I still to be determined.
Yeah, it was a remarkable election. He won with over 10 million more votes than his nearest competitor. So that really was an interesting return. But you're right. We'll have to see how this plays out and watch as he takes office, as I said, in August.
you know, the president has not only these foreign policy challenges, clearly, you know, with its relations with the West, but also domestic challenges. There are a lot of there's a lot of reconciliation that needs to be done in Iran. And so the president has said that he's there to do exactly that, to focus on the economy and domestic social issues. And then, of course, has the foreign policy challenges ahead of him as well. So definitely something that will be interesting going forward.
Yeah, and he plays a unique role as both an insider and an outsider in some way. So, yes, we will keep an eye on that for sure. So thank you again so much, Suzette, for joining us. Have safe travels, and we'll see you in the studio next week.
Thank you, Rebecca. I look forward to being back in Norman next week.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions that you may have. Write to us at worldviews@ou.edu or send us a tweet at worldviewskgou. Next, Suzette Grulot talks with Daniel Sargent. He's an assistant professor of history at the University of California in Berkeley and the author of the forthcoming book, A Superpower Transformed: History, Strategy, and American Foreign Policy in the 1970s. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. By the end of the 1970s, China started to move towards a market economy, and Iran overthrew its monarchy to replace it with an Islamic theocracy. My guest today writes that the decade transformed international politics and introduced the world to the phenomenon of globalization. Daniel Sargent is an assistant professor of history at the University of California in Berkeley and the author of the forthcoming book, A Superpower Transformed: History, Strategy, and American Foreign Policy in the 1970s.
Daniel Sargent, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
So you've written before about global history, basically, since 1945 or in the post-Cold War period. You've written about some of the changes that we've witnessed in that period of time. What would you say are some of the most significant changes we've seen in global history in the post-World War II period?
Okay, there are a huge number of changes that have transformed the international system. First, I think, is the rise of the state system. And in 1945, the foundational membership of the United Nations comprises about 50 countries. Today we have almost 200 countries that are part of the United Nations family of nation states. That's one big change. Second change, I think, has to do with the rise of what we call globalization. The thick networks of trade and financial interconnection between nation states that bind nation states into sort of common transnational communities of fate, if you will, is a hugely important development. It's made the nation state less autonomous, less sovereign in some respects than sort of, you know, classic model of Westphalian international relations would presume. So those are, you know, two huge structural developments that have had tremendous repercussions for the way that the international system works.
So when you say repercussions, what exactly do you mean by that? Because you said in some of your work that during this period we've seen an interplay between forces of integration and disintegration, and that that has come to define our globe. So is that what you mean by the repercussions?
Well, I think that's one of the repercussions. Now, this is not an original point. I think that the social theorist Benjamin Barba made that point very well when he described the conflict between integration and disintegration as a conflict between the forces of jihad, signifying disintegration, and McWorld, signifying integration. As a dialectical way of thinking about sort of the large-scale processes that are making the world that we inhabit today, I think it's useful. But I don't think it suffices to describe that dialectic as sort of the total framework for understanding the, you know, complicated forces that make international relations today so very fraught. It's amidst important developments like nationalism, which remains a very definitive force, defining force in international relations today, but it's not necessarily either an integrative or a disintegrative development. It maybe exists somewhere between the two.
So what about the issue of prosperity versus poverty? So during this period of time that you study the kind of history of the world, if you will, since the Second World War, we've seen decolonization, we've seen, you know, globalization, as you've mentioned, the rise of the modern state system. And we've seen, obviously, a tremendous growth in prosperity around the world. But we've also seen a significant continuance of poverty. So how do we make sense of
kind of these two views of the world, these two different perspectives on the world. So on the one hand, we were talking about disintegration and integration, and now kind of prosperity and poverty.
Well, that's a terrific question. I actually think that's the most important question of all when we think about the problems that define sort of this period of study, post-war international relations. And there are very different ways of viewing the problem. And let me just crudely put forward two perspectives. The first perspective, I think, would see poverty as a consequence or function of prosperity. In this view of things, the endurance of wide-scale human deprivation in the global south is a consequence of the affluence that we in the West enjoy. A second perspective, and one which I have somewhat more affinity myself, would see poverty not as a consequence of prosperity, but rather as an enduring, frustratingly enduring and stubborn fact of human existence. You know, in a sense, poverty is the natural condition of humankind. What we have to explain is prosperity. Why have some nations been able to escape the desperate trap of poverty while others have languished within it? I think if we look at the post-war period as a whole, all the way through to the present day, then this contemporary history, it's a period of, 65 years of history, actually reveals some fairly encouraging, even optimistic lessons. Over the past 65 years, the gaps between the haves and have-nots have narrowed considerably. Growth over the past two or three decades has been focused overwhelmingly outside of the advanced capitalist countries in East Asia, in sub-Saharan Africa more recently. In fact, over the last decade, sub-Saharan Africa was the fastest growing region of the world.
Who's responsible for that? Is there anyone that's responsible for that in terms of these kind of this optimistic view that we can take and the fact that this gap has narrowed between, if you will, the global north and the global south?
This is not a terribly original answer to the question, but I think the answer is simply development or modernization.
So in terms of foreign policy then and states that can have an impact on development around the world and to bring it back to the Western world, one of the things that you spend a lot of time focusing on is American foreign policy and particularly foreign policy in the 70s as it was undergoing as globalization was really heating up, if you will. You've mentioned how the United States suffered from some crises because of this, but then was able to kind of revitalize itself because of globalization. But what is it about the 70s that draws you to study American foreign policy of the 70s? And how is it that from that point on, the United States has perhaps had anything to do with the perpetuation of prosperity or growth and development around the world?
Well, that's a really interesting question. It's a difficult question. What drew me to the 70s was the change that the decade signified in the overarching priorities of U.S. foreign policy. Prior to the 70s, the U.S. is very actively engaged in working to promote development and modernization within foreign countries in the developing world. Kennedy introduces the Alliance for Progress in Latin America. Similar kinds of initiatives are introduced relating to other regions of the world. And these efforts prove largely unsuccessful, efforts by the United States to promote or sort of speed up development within the context of the foreign nation state, a struggle to achieve the results that U.S. policymakers hope that they will accomplish. Thereafter, from the 70s onwards, the United States is actually much less engaged in working to promote development, certainly in working to promote development at the national scale. What the U.S. does do, which I think is useful, is it continues to exercise a rudimentary set of responsibilities for the sustenance of what you might call international economic order. And insofar as the preservation of a basically liberal and open international trading system serves the sort of purpose of global economic development, the United States warrants some credit for that.
Our guest is Daniel Sargent, a UC Berkeley historian and the author of the soon-to-be-published book A Superpower Transformed, History, Strategy, and American Foreign Policy in the 1970s. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. let's get back to Suzette Gerlach's conversation with University of California, Berkeley historian Daniel Sargent. He argues that after the 1970s, the United States took a step back from actively promoting modernization in the developing world. Just before the break, he told Suzette that the United States deserves credit for preserving an open international trading system to sustain global economic development.
So in addition to credit for this type of approach, and you've written extensively on the subject of globalization and American foreign policy, but you've also focused on human rights and American foreign policy. You've talked about how American foreign policy has kind of rediscovered human rights as a central and fundamental aspect of its foreign policy and kind of a human rights doctrine that defines foreign policy. What do you mean by human rights kind of serving as the center of foreign policy, and how does that square with the focus on globalization? Because many of us tend to think of, you know, kind of you focus on one or the other, but not both, and that they aren't necessarily mutually reinforcing. But apparently that isn't the case.
Well, there's a lot there. So let me try to unpack some of this. First of all, can I clarify rediscovery? The reason that I use the word rediscovery rather than discovery is that the idea of universal human rights is not original to the 1970s. In fact, this is an idea that is articulated very early in the post-war order. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is a United Nations document, is signed in 1948, right at the beginning of the post-war era. But its aspirations languished for the first couple of decades after the Second World War. And in part, that's because the obstacles to the realization of universal human rights are very substantial. Sovereignty, in principle, is a major obstacle. In a world of independent nation states, each sovereign and presumably inviolable in its own domestic affairs, how is the United Nations or the United States or any other entity supposed to, you know, do the work of human rights enforcement? It's a really difficult question. In the 70s, a partial answer to that question is devised, initially not by the United States, but by non-governmental organizations like Amnesty International that aspire to wield the force of unarmed global opinion as a sort of weapon on behalf of universal human rights. And this is an approach that, you know, struggles to achieve the outcomes that human rights enthusiasts hope that it will accomplish. But it does encourage some policymakers in the United States on both the Republican and the Democratic side of the partisan divide to take human rights more seriously. Of course, this is all happening in the context of an ongoing Cold War in which human rights also have an appeal as a sort of instrument for assailing the Soviet Union, which remains, you know, a notorious violator of human rights, particularly so far as the civil and political rights of its citizens are concerned. And it's in this, you know, complicated conjuncture that human rights become a priority for U.S. foreign policy. The breakthrough years are really in the middle of the 1970s, 1974, 1975, 1976. These are the years in which Congress for the first time acts to legislate human rights into the legal framework governing the making and implementation of U.S. foreign policy. Carter is the first president, maybe the last president too, to really situate human rights at the center of his foreign policy agenda. For at least a couple of years, human rights do constitute something like an overarching strategic purpose for the Carter administration. It's also a very fuzzy strategic purpose, and the Carter administration quickly retreats from it towards a more traditional conception of Cold War foreign policy. Thereafter, human rights have remained important as a kind of ulterior framework of ethical or normative reference for foreign policy. But it's very, very hard to sort of operationalize foreign policy around human rights promotion as a strategic purpose because, you know, even, you know, within the United States, there's not a whole lot of agreement as to what that, you know, would look like or comprise as a practical foreign policy agenda.
So these two then are or are not opposed to one another, focused on globalization and economic growth and trade versus human rights?
I don't think they're opposed. I think that the forces that produce sort of consciousness of globalization as an economic phenomenon and consciousness of global human rights are closely analogous, if not identical. I mean, there's a kind of technological material dynamic underpinning both sets of developments. Innovations in communications technologies, for example, facilitate the integration of financial markets. They also facilitate the transmission of knowledge about human rights conditions within countries to well-intentioned activists in foreign countries who then agitate on behalf of human rights victims. So the underlying structural developments that produce these phenomena are, from a point of view, almost one and the same.
But the United States has somewhat of a mixed record on human rights, does it not? I mean, particularly, from this period, the 70s onward, and even today. I mean, we struggle with maintaining, our relations with others on the basis of human rights and putting that front and center versus other aspects such as trade and open markets and realist perspectives of power and position.
No, I think that's absolutely right. But I think that it's evocative of the power that human rights have assumed that you even pose the question in those terms. Because at the end of the 1960s, for example, one might have been concerned about the ethical implications of the Vietnam War. Many people were. But that question would probably not have been formulated in terms of human rights outcomes. We might have, made specific reference to the human consequences of the Indochina War for, the Vietnamese and their neighbors. But we likely would not have talked about human rights as a sort of global, normative reference point against which foreign policy ought to be measured. The fact that we do so today, I think, is illustrative of the power that the human rights idea has come to assume. Of course, the fact that we intermittently articulate human rights purposes as an overarching purpose of foreign policy does not mean that we always live up to those aspirations. They are aspirations, not a rigid code of conduct.
So the Obama doctrine, then, if there is one today, human rights are fundamental to that?
I think Obama has been much more cautious on this issue than his predecessor. I think under the George W. Bush administration, we saw something like the apotheosis of an ideological approach to foreign policy that had its genesis in the 1970s. Obama, I would argue, has retreated considerably from that ideological approach to the world towards a more balanced, realistic, or Kissingerian approach, if you call it what you will.
Well, thank you so much, Daniel Sargent, for joining us today. Very interesting historical discussion. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Suzette Gerlot's conversation with Daniel Sargent, a historian at the University of California in Berkeley and the author of the upcoming book, A Superpower Transformed: History, Strategy, and American Foreign Policy in the 1970s. Worldviews is a production of KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview, Hallie Arias writes and produces our web content, and the show is edited by Brian Hardzinski. For Suzette Gerlot, I'm Rebecca Cruz.